We will go some more, Bob.
Well, I've got a whole bunch of Samuel Crawford. He's Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. I've got dozens of his books with his name in it. And I don't know what to do with them. I want to get rid of them. They're not worth anything. Hume's History of England and things that were, I suppose, in the 40s and 50s. And I don't know what to do with them, but I'd like to dispose of them. All right.
Well, at any rate, to complete the little tale, Mrs. The widow, Penberthy, wouldn't give the widow Williams, who became Mrs. Tregay, her deed. And Mrs. Tregay took her to court, and the judge said, okay, I've heard the evidence. I find in favor of Mrs. Tregay, and Mrs. Williams had to give her the deed. And that was that. So we know how, from that instance, how kind of sloppy Mr. Kislingberry must have been initially with his land dealings, and we've also been able to date within a matter of months the erection of the cottage for Mrs. Williams and her husband Henry. Now they were a bit older. They were in their 50s or late 40s when that thing was erected, and we haven't been able to learn anything more about Henry Williams or Ann Williams. And we hope that maybe you've at least heard their
Sounds
names.
Sounds like a Welshman.
Yeah, I did.
We think that she's related somehow to either the Carbises or the Thomases, but we aren't sure.
Carbis built the last house that Carbis built. Let's see, was it this house, rock house down here, or was it up here? James Carbis.
Oh. When was this about?
Well, when did Carvis die?
We've never found that out.
We've got a picture of him.
Oh, you do. Is it in the Mineral Point room?
Yeah.
Great.
You got a full gray beard. James Carvis.
And he was a Mason?
Oh, yes.
Stone Mason.
I think he would have died long before you were born. And his,
I think so.
His children...
Roy might have been living.
It's his widow who died in 1903, Elizabeth, and she died at the home of her daughter Susan Teasdale out in Iowa and was brought back here for burial. And then there were others in that family. Yeah. Are you familiar with the Charles family? Susan...
John Charles, the carpenter?
No, I'm not. I don't know. Carl?
Charles.
Oh, Charles. Oh.
And Wassley. Charles and Wassley had some kind of furniture store. Because I got, makes me so annoyed. I had this, I got half of the sign of Charles and Wassley. And I had it up at the museum for a while. Somebody wanted to white board, so they took the half of the sign and sawed it up. I've got the other half.
So the Carbises are strangers, not exactly strangers. Mrs. Carbis, we think James Carbis had a sister who was married to Richard Goldsworthy. Does that make sense? Richard Goldsworthy? But they and their daughter Fanny married Mr. Charles.
Those are these were a dime a dozen.
Okay. Now, where did the Prittos live in Prittle Hollow, which is Spruce Street, or what's often called Prittle Hollow on pictures we've seen?
Prittix,
you say?
Prittix.
Oh boy. Okay, critics, I'll have to change my ways.
And it was spelled phonetically, P-R-E-D-I-X, I think, critics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you've seen that?
Yeah.
Are there descendants of those numerous critics still around here?
No.
Well, Ethel?
Jesse and Nettie.
Or Jesse and Nettie, yeah.
Prito.
Yeah, they're dead.
Well, their Brito's in Dodgeville. He was postmaster, wasn't he?
I don't know.
Bob Brito.
Oh, I believe that's right, yes. Uh-huh. Well, when Ethel Trudinick, when she was a British, wasn't she? Sure.
Ethel?
Sure.
Ethel Brito, yes.
Yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Here's my partner, Edgar.
Right.
Hi, Edgar.
We're adding another voice to the tape, and it's going to be that of Edgar Hellum.
Did you get the password from
him? The password? No, there isn't a password. Maybe we should move your chair closer so you're near the microphone.
You may sit here.
You know, on your early abstract, or any of the names, early names, not the name early, but early names.
You mean for the Pendarvis properties?
No, on your Effie Early's house.
Oh, yes. At Brewer.
Brito?
Yes, I think so. You get out the abstract. I don't remember them, but it goes way back. It goes back to 47.
Oh, God.
A long abstract.
Which lot, which outlot are you on, Mr. Hill?
Which lot?
Outlot, the original outlot number. Do you remember? You 187 or something like that.
I'm not sure.
Now, maybe you could show them a map so we can...
Gee, I wouldn't want your job.
Gosh. What?
Hard job.
Well, that, Dan has done all the work. He brings it the office and I look at it.
This is the... in two sections.
Okay, we know that John Gray and Samson Thomas built the east house in the row, Tamlin's Row, in about 1844. And we're convinced from an 1846 census that John Gray and his wife, Susan Gray, Susan Thomas Gray, lived there very briefly. The Grays, Alma particularly, and all of her husband's family never associated themselves with any of those properties down there. Do you ever associate them with that area at all? Not at all. So that
they built the Gray house was built about in the 60s, I would say, about the same time that Joe Gundry built the museum.
Oh, yeah.
Because
the Gray house on Maiden Street.
Street. And the newel post of the Gray house and the newel post over at Uncle Will's are identical. So they must have had the same carpenters or had access to the same materials.
What about Bowden's, the name, B-A-W-D-A?
Bowden?
Bowden, no, I don't know.
Bowden. I knew Ed Bowden. That's all I know.
Where did he live, Roy?
He lived up there.
Kitty Corner from St. Paul's?
As you turn to go on Fountain Street.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Was he a carpenter builder type?
I think he was a farmer. I think.
Well, Billy Bowden works over in Blackville.
Oh.
At the Timbers.
Oh, really? Oh, yes, that's the daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw her there one time. That's right.
What about the Renfrey family?
Oh, Harold Renfrey.
Are they related to Andrew?
Related to the Ingleses? His mother was an Ingles.
Related to Millie Bray, too.
Yeah.
Well, the Renfreys, that's a, well, I won't say well-known name, but it's an early name that's associated with the community. I don't know what Harold Renfrey was.
Yeah, Harold Renfrey, uh-huh. He had another brother. There's two of them.
Well, the far west end of the Spruce Street lots, the original Outlaws, was sliced off by Mr. Renfrey, sometime, about when, Dan?
About 1855, I believe.
100 feet, and he evidently lived there, built a house up there. And we wonder whether there are any members of that family around. But you've named some of them. Where could we find them?
who lived in the house that had the greenhouse on it that Bill Kissenberry talked about up in the back?
Goldsworthy, the Verned.
The Goldsworthys.
Goldsworthy. That was quite a house in its day.
Which Goldsworthy? Do you know the name?
No, I don't.
What house was that?
Roy, I'm surprised you don't remember that fire.
I don't. No, sir, I don't recall that.
Well, then the old man bought that whole, he had 11 acres there. And we bought the 100 feet from him, you know.
Haas.
And he owned that place where the house had stood, and then all up in back of the precinct.
Is there anything left of that? I haven't been up there in years.
Foundation.
Foundation is still there?
Well, that must be the Goldsworthys that ended up owning that whole. They were descended from the Tamblyns, by the way.
Oh.
Mrs. Goldsworthy was a Tamblyn daughter. There were two generations of Goldsworthys.
Mrs. Tamblyn was a Goldsworthy.
Isaac Tamblyn had a daughter who married a Goldsworthy and inherited the property, and then their daughter sold it.
Well, we wanted to square off the piece of property.
Oh yeah, you had a mess there.
And include that great big elm tree, which of course we lost in the meantime. But Haas sort of laughed at us. He said, "Well, why don't you buy the whole farm?" I think we offered him $100 for the footage. It wasn't.
Oops.
I remember what it was 10 on feet. Spruce Street, but then it included a piece of land up in the back of the row.
Took a job.
I'll sell you the whole thing for $1,100. So for another $1,000, we could have had the whole farm. And we didn't know what to do with the property. Well, after all, we had more property than we wanted.
11 acres of land, though. What would you do with
it? It was too bad that we didn't buy it, because we could have made some money, or we would have protected the house. This was jeopardized recently when they wanted to put a roadway down alongside the road to go up to the new subdivision, and it would have spoiled the whole thing. That would have been a regular thoroughfare, and if we'd owned that piece of property, they wouldn't do it. Well, so far, fortunately, it hasn't happened.
I hope it doesn't.
There's a house that stands today that is just up Spruce Street, it's the next house up from the row house. It looks like that may have been an old house.
That is an old house. You've never,
brick.
Part of it is brick.
Right.
That's
Bill Priestley.
Priestley's house.
Bill Priestley's Bill house, Priestley, but yeah. I don't know who owned it before him.
Yeah. Well, that might be a Renfrey or Prideaux.
It looks like it's the property that a Stephen Prideaux Sr. owned.
Uh-huh. It's on that part of it. We've not measured that.
No, but it would be most likely to be that house that we see in 1871 map.
So that should be Stephen Prideaux Sr. and Jr. would live down below on the east end of the row. Between Kislingberry or Polperro and the row. There was an early house in 1843 that Stephen Prideaux Jr. bought a lot for and lived in with oodles of kids. They had at least 10. I don't know how they've survived.
Well, the one thing we never ran down about the row, the log house probably was the first house. And the only thing we ever found out, that it was like a miner would live there, would be here in the summertime, and in the wintertime would go south to Missouri. I can't remember who, whether Bill Kissenberry conjectured that or not. We never found out definitely.
Well,
and we've never run down the papers on that particular piece of property to find out if that was the earliest one. Because seemingly then the rock portion, the rest of the row, was added onto that house, you see. And Tamlin got
it. Well, we've figured out everything except just that. We're waiting to get from Washington the original preemption papers, or copies of them, I should say, for the lots. until now, until we began this work, the nowhere in Wisconsin were there the original town site records for Mineral Point. There's a separate book that never was given to the National Archives of the town site sales at the Bureau of Land Management, which is in Alexandria, Virginia. But they filmed that for us, and we've now got all of that plus the certificate numbers. The certificates themselves, with the preemption proofs and descriptions of the property, presumably, we aren't sure because we haven't seen it yet, are at the National Archives, and we're waiting for those to come. So we'll know, but our presumption is that in 39, judging from the sale prices for those properties, and there were three classes of properties in Mineral Point on Vliet survey and Harrison surveys, and these were the third class, which should mean unimproved in all respects. So in 39, there was probably nothing there at all. But by 44, there must have been something there, because when Mr. Sampson Thomas and John Gray put up the east house in the row, they lined it up more or less with what was there. Otherwise, there would have been no reason to build them in what appears to be a line. They could have picked, that hill gave you many options for house placement, but the Cornish habit seems to have been, even in countryside building, when they would erect temporary villages to extract mineral deposits of rather minimal extent, they put up stone houses in the middle of the countryside and abandoned them within a few years' time, and they would often build them in terraces, and there's still ruins of those here and there. You're probably familiar with them, Mr. Neal. Dorothy Sweet has helped us. She is head of the Cornish Family Association, and we've been in touch with her.
Is she Rogers?
She's from Cornwall, and she lives in Newquay, I think.
That statement certainly true. And when I was in Cornwall, I couldn't understand how they would abandon.
They were temporary.
That's right. But here they put up these tremendous stone buildings, all the timber gone, but the whole stone structure is there. And my first reaction, the people that I stayed with, I said, well, could we buy that property? Well, he didn't know, what would you do with it? And I said, well, I put the floors back and I put the roof on. And I said, you'd have the most marvelous building. Well, I suppose you could, he said. And so once or twice, we stopped the car and we walked down to these buildings. And here is the great chimney for the steam lifts and things, all standing. Then in the town of St. Day itself, which is the old mining town like Mineral Point was here, so many houses, and I said, oh, what a time you could have to come back here and restore these. Well, funny enough, Derek became interested, and the third time I went over, he said, oh, you have to come and see. He said, we bought a little house, and we went over on a hillside, and here was a very small stone cottage with a spring still running in the back yard, rock formation in the back, and this little spring running out. And he said, now we're fixing this wing. This is your wing. He said, when you come back to Cornwall. And I said, well, I'm coming back. Oh, you're going to retire in Cornwall. And I said, my partner's the one that should retire in Cornwall. He's a Cornish and I'm a full-blooded Norwegian. But they insisted that that's where I was going to be and going to have. Well, they didn't attempt restoration. Poor man, he didn't have too much know-how. But, I could have had fun if I could spend a few years in Cornwall and put some of these buildings back again, you know.
Still hundreds of them, I'm told.
Oh, yes. An unlimited amount of rock, of course. you could buy two or three houses and buy one or two others and have the extra rock for replacement. We could do it there just like we did here in Mineral Point.
I think probably more so. They're more available there. Here at Mineral Point, we've pretty much exhausted the family names, but I'll go on with the long list of persons that we've associated with the site and see whether any of them ring bells. Thomas Kinsman, I should tell you that we are in touch with Kinsman descendants. Do you know of any? Gail Clayton of Madison is doing, a Kinsman descendant is doing a long genealogy of the Kinsman family.
Helen Kinsman.
Yeah.
Bobby Kinsman.
Their brother and sister, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
But Do you know whether they ever feel that they have anything to do with Pendarvis in the dim, dark past?
No, I don't think so.
Thomas Whitford, did any of the Whitfords ever, you say
yeah,
there are a zillion of them.
Oh, there's a lot of Whitfords, yeah.
Do they claim Kislingberry family?
Blanche Stewart told me her mother was a Whitford, you know.
Oh.
And I think Blanche told me that her grandfather, Whitford, and Tuwik were married in Paul Perrow. You remember Blanche saying that? From the librarian here.
Could be.
Well, the Whitfords are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
There were a lot of Whitfords.
I already asked you about Walter Darlington.
Yeah.
And Richard Moyle. Never heard of him. John Hitchens.
Hitchens, Orange.
Was a name that's familiar, but I never knew anything about him.
Okay.
Hitchens, there was an attorney from out in Iowa. Did she have any relation to the Hineses? Do you know that? Banker Hines? They had a farm west of Middle Point.
What was his name? Hitchens?
Hines here, but Hitchens, this attorney used to come from out west. I used to take him out the farm. He still had interest in the property out there. But that's the only time I ever heard that name.
Right.
Fine. Thomas Martin, descendants of, he was the one who first owned the row house properties, both outlots. He died very soon thereafter. His son, John, and John's wife, Christina, inherited most of it, and a little bit of it was inherited by Richard and Elizabeth Oates. Do any of those names?
The Oates, yeah. Senior Oates.
Tell us about Senior Oates.
John Oates.
There are three sisters and they call them Faith, Hope, and Charity.
Well, Senior Oates, didn't she teach Sunday school?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I think I had her as a Sunday school teacher.
She used to come put a penny on the book. Don't you know she read your name and you go and put a penny on the book?
No.
They had it.
What church was that?
Was the
Congregational.
Oates woman that owned the little house up on the highway that we wanted to buy. Emma?
Cena, wasn't it? Cena Oates?
Johnny Oates used to deliver milk around town. Don't you remember? Blow
well, the Oates house is still standing out
there.
Yeah,
out there.
But this little house that we wanted to buy was a frame house and they tore it down.
Uh-huh.
But we wanted to buy that. That was a marvelous old house.
Yes, it was.
So there are lots of Oates still around.
No, there's no descendants. They were old maids and old bachelor, weren't they?
They weren't.
Quite unlike Elizabeth, I might add, who was kicked out of the Methodist church here for having had her first child after 5 months of marriage. The Methodist records are very precise on the point. At a trial.
Well, the Presbyterian records of the Presbyterian church that turned over the Middle Point room, there are any number of entries of where somebody went to a dance and they were excommunicated.
For having a good time.
Or they went sitting next to him in church.
Well, Mrs. Williams was kicked out for not attending meetings. Well, the Priddicks, as we've done, the Tregaskis family, I'm not sure whether I'm saying that right. Tregaskis.
How do you spell?
Tregaskis.
Tregaskis' store was in near where you were born.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There was a
lady years ago that came out to Pendarvis. She said, I think she said, I'm Emily Wright Tregaskis.
Never heard that name.
Wasn't there a Tregaskis in connection with what was left of where Kenny Colwell owns Red Brick House? And the creamery was. There were two stores in there, a Milner store and a butcher shop, as I remember. But that's way back. It seems to me there was a Tregaskis in connection with that.
Well, the Tregaskis store.
Yeah, I didn't remember
that. Let's see that postcard.
Will you give it back?
Well, maybe there was a sign on it. Horton Commerce Street.
That's me walking up.
Looks like you.
Yeah. Really?
No.
I was expecting a toddler and this full-grown man.
Well, that's Tregaskis has a store in there.
Oh, my gosh, I never heard that name before.
Oh, you have to. No, Tregaskis.
I thought he was trying to say Tregilgis.
No, Tregaskis. All right, next.
Okay, that's right. Anna John Roll, R-O-L-L, or Rule or Roll.
We never aren't. Heard of him.
She was Norwegian.
Never heard of them. You
they were the first. They were. They appear in the 1840 census as living in the log house at the west end of the row.
Oh.
1850 census, I should say. Okay, Joseph Noakes and Richard Oakes. Well, we've done the Oakses, but not the Noakses. Ever hear of any Noakses?
No. Oakes, yeah.
Noakes. I never heard of any Noakes. Noakes,
but Oakes was.
Yeah. Okay. John Ray, Henry Ray, John Coe, and Felix Coe. They
don't mean anything to me.
Okay. Presley Spruance, Jacob Raymond, John Ham, and Benjamin Ham.
No.
Well, I'll identify them for you. Joseph Noakes and Richard Oakes were the persons who had the preemption rights on the Shake Rag lot, 192. And they sold those rights to Richard Kislingberry. Now, the lot 190, the preemption rights were first held by John Ray, Henry Ray, John Cole, and Felix Cole, and they sold those to Thomas Martin. And on lot 191, Presley Spruance, Jacob Raymond, John Hamm, and Benjamin Hamm were the preemptors who sold their rights to Thomas Martin for the same property. Much of that area, the mining properties down in that end of town, were in fact not originally bought by the original preemptors. The original preemptors sold or assigned their rights to a bunch of Cornish men and a bunch of Yankees and other Americans. Much more than half of the property was originally claimed by others. Well, that ends the who do you know part of this business. Thank heavens, we've been on it forever.
There's a Homer Ray that lives just down here in the next corner. I don't know that any kin.
Well, that's interesting with the Kislingberry. They own what is now the park.
Yeah.
And had that whole piece as a farm. And I don't think we ever did determine, or we never brought up it in a conversation. The log house, Paul, as we have restored Palpero, was owned by Kislingberry.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly built by Kislingberry. Bill Kislingberry, our carpenter, said his grandfather built that house.
I'm sure he could have.
But whether he lived there first then and then went over to the park, that we never determined.
Now, is the house still standing?
That's Palpero.
Across?
No.
His old house was destroyed over in the park, what was left of it. And there was park. There was quite a lot of
log
park,
and we tried to save the
most marvelous double root cellar that they destroyed.
We begged them
to not destroy it, to keep it even in connection with the park.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm going to step over this wire here.
Oh,
that they destroyed.
That's all right.
When would that be? When they destroyed that building, Mom?
Oh, at the log building.
Over in the park.
Well, do you remember?
We brought home the log building, and we got some of the rock. But let's see, what year would that be?
No, where they are.
It's not that far back.
Well,
probably in 60.
I would think.
In connection with the park and the dance hall, they used this as a. They had toilet facilities and a. Caretaker's house, I think, in connection with it.
I think so, yeah.
And then they finally decided to destroy all that, because then they bought the property up in the back of that.
That must have been a later generation.
Got a caretaker's house up there. And then they destroyed that and only begged them. And then we went over and salvaged what we could of it.
Mm-hmm. That couldn't have been George Kissingbury, though, because George Kissingbury died in Polperro.
No, this would be...
one of his sons.
His son, right.
Ah.
We know that because the last Kissingbury daughter, whose name I've forgotten, but who was the ancestor of...
Cora.
Yeah, she was born there, and she wasn't very old when her father died.
Ida.
And then when Mrs. Kissingbury remarried Mr. Pierce, they moved to this part of town. They moved out of the ward altogether with Ida and left that house and evidently rented it out for a time before they sold it. So I'm pretty sure, since Ida was the youngest and she had always told people who are now living that she was born.
When you bought the property on Shea Craig, did you have it surveyed?
Yes.
And were there survey stakes to mark off the boundaries of the lots?
Not old ones.
They put new ones
but
in?
They put metal pins down.
But when was this, in the 30s?
No, Ernie Clark did the survey for us from Platteville. He was connected with the mining school over there. And the New Jersey Zinc used him for a surveyor for their mining businesses.
We had a complete new survey when we incorporated with the Cathedral. That was done by another surveyor. And that's when they used the point up at the water tower to determine.
No, they came down from Nell Yikes from the corner of the Bleach Survey, lot number one.
Oh.
Came all...
Good Lord.
Way down.
But in the old records it said to a rock or to a tree or things like that, as many of the old ones did, of course, and of course those were long since gone. I don't remember the debate about the alleyway. It sort of seemed like to us that we owned up to this alley, and we had to leave it there. And then when Harris was going to move his fence line down, we told him that he couldn't do it, so he moved it back to where the original fence line
was. Well, none of the original deeds that we've read mention any alleyway restrictions.
No. Will said it was never recorded, and it was just an understanding.
I think there are a lot of understandings for the very first about Mineral Point, and they come to haunt you 150 years later. Well, back to these lists of questions. When you think of Mineral Point, certainly the Pendaris area has been associated. Well, back to Dan's question for Edgar first. Do you know of a relationship between Richard and George Kissingbury?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Do you, Bob?
You know that Will was the son of President George
in St. Louis.
They didn't either.
No. They didn't know.
No.
Francis doesn't know much about the early Kissingberries. There's some Kissingberries over in Linden too.
Right. There's a descendant of Frank Kissingberry in California today who traces his ancestries back to Linden.
Yeah.
But whether Richard Kissingbury Mineral Point is related to the Lyndon Kissingberrys, that's another question.
Yeah, I can tell you that.
Well, we also know, to tell you what we do know, that George was ill with TB, evidently, in the 1850s. That's what killed him in 1870. We found that in Oddfellow's records. Wow. And he went to Cornwall and was in the Royal Infirmary in Truro, and assigned a power of attorney to his wife, I think, here in Mineral Point. And so we know when he was gone in 53, he had gone to California and then evidently went to England to recover his health. How long he was gone, we don't know. We also know that he seems to have been a carpenter in addition to being a miner, because in one of the court cases that is now at the collection of Platteville, from the courthouse. He did work on a brewery which stood next to Bill Kiddo's house, where the Dyke now has a place. That was an 1840 brewery built.
Not early. 1830.
Said it was started in 40. So in January 40, John Phillips began a brewery there.
Oh, there's a brewery. That's where they used to go and get straight grain alcohol.
Yeah. John or
Bert Opie.
Bert Opie and
Joe Lang.
Joe Lang argued about that. Oh yes, they made liquor up there. He said they made liquor up there, and we had never heard about it. And they had themselves quite an argument. I don't think they ever told us exactly.
Oh, it was
they
there.
Didn't call it a brewery, I don't think.
Well, it was probably, he also had a distillery, we think.
Well, that would be the distillery, probably.
But in 43, a malt house was erected. The bills were never properly paid. And Kislingberry's bills for working on the malt house, which were larger than anybody else's bills for that, are in there. And so we assume he was a carpenter or construction person of some sort. And there, it seems to have been a wooden structure rather than a masonry structure. So that's what makes
I'll us. I'll have to play over Bert Wolfie's and Joe's tape. I've got out the house. See what they say. They're always arguing.
Well, it'd be just like our story. Joe would tell the story, and then when he got through, Bert says it never went that way at all. And so Joe would say, well, all right, how did it go then? And so then Bert would tell his version. Well, basically, the thing was there, but Joe was a great one to, if you had a story, he could make it better. But he always, you know, he enlarged a little bit on his, whereas Bert Opie was going to stick a little bit more to the facts. But,
okay.
And then the foundry that was down there, that was the other interesting thing that
now, where is this foundry? He's coming up, and I keep getting
right
lost.
Down. The Warren House is the Warren Foundry. And the Warren House is now owned by George Ness up on the hill and down
right
in the valley on Schaefray. And I don't know whether there's, seems to me I've got a picture of what's left of the foundry.
Well, Joe had a job to sit on the roof when they were firing up to pour the metal, and he got, what was it, 5 cents a day?
Mm-hmm.
With a bucket of water and a dipper.
Not much money. Well, in Mineral Point, one question that Alice Smith always asked, and it's a darn good one. Who really ran things? The Yankees, the Cornish, or other English-speaking immigrants? Or was it pretty much run democratically? When I say ran things, I mean in terms of commerce and politics and government.
I think it was pretty general. I don't think there was anybody that...
No.
No distinction. What
I
about...
I followed Alice a few years ago out in Laguna Hills.
Mm-hmm.
A nice visit with her.
She's rather frail now, and of course her voice is very much affected, but her letters are still just as bright as they ever were.
Well, you could take, I suppose.
She was an historian for the society, Mr. Penworthy.
The problem in the families, Cawthorns, the Crawfords, the Gundrys,
the Rosses.
The Rosses. They were the sort of the leading influence in the community. I don't know just how far back. Goes it to go back to the 60s? Was it go back before? I don't know that we know anybody about before the Civil War.
Well,
what about Judge Strong?
Yes, and Strong. Mm-hmm. But now they're gonna, are they Cornish?
No.
Irish?
Strong
English?
Came from Vermont. Moses Strong came from Vermont. Let's see, did he? Am I thinking, no, I'm thinking of the Washington.
Connecticut, I seem to recall.
Yeah. He's a Yankee at any rate.
Yeah.
What about Cothran? Well, we
don't know where he came from. The Cothran stuff.
Wouldn't be very too hard to run that.
No, we could do that as long as you've given us the names of whom you feel.
He was a Yankee, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Cothran, yes.
The name that's always intrigued me, I've got a tax roll of 49. And a name that's always intrigued me is a heavy property owner here was a George Vanderbilt. Now that must have been Eastern interests in Clarion.
Which part of town?
Out of town. And I don't know whether it was over here. I can't remember. He owned a lot of, George Vanderbilt owned a lot of land. It's 49.
Well, of course, I'm from the outside, so just the impressions that I remember over the years, but it always seems to me that the Cornish were very reticent about being leaders. They were hardworking, poor. If they had 5 or 6 days work and a couple of ales on Saturday night and church on Sunday and meeting house on Wednesday, that was about all they wanted. And I don't remember any one name that was definitely Cornish in all the things that we've heard or remember. In fact, I think even when I was in Cornwall, that was true. I went up to Paul Perrow, who wanted to see the old house, and was taken up there. And the house itself had been destroyed for tax purposes, but the outbuilding was there.
You don't mean Paul Perrow, you mean Pendarvis.
Pendarvis, rather, yes. And in the gable of the outbuilding was a clock. Well, like a town clock that was still running, and that was from 1100. I went up to Truro then, to the museum, to find out. They told me that if I went up there, they would show me a picture of the old house. Well, there again, I suppose, being Pendarvis, and it's V-E-S instead of I-S, we changed it intentionally. They were definitely Cornish, but there were three villages in the amount of land that they had that were complete. The whole thing was such that they were completely self-sustaining.
Well, it was good.
They had a leatherworks, they had a brewery, they had a winery, they had, there was everything all there, and everything all focused up to the big house on the hill. But all those people were subservient. Well, there evidently had to be a few leading Cornish, you know.
Well, you know, the layout of Mineral Point is suspicious because there's Strong's addition, which is practically, begins at practically the same time that Vliet's survey is done at government insistence and Harrison's survey was done at government insistence. And then there's that one little fragment of the lower corner of the, that would be the southeast corner of Strong's addition that maintains the street pattern of Vliet's survey. And in fact, in the original deeds to Vliet's survey, we now see that they were made exceptions, except for the properties owned by so-and-so and so-and-so. Strong and his partners each owned a fragment of that 40-acre plot that became Strong's addition.
Where did Garrett Vliet come from, do you know?
Yeah, I've forgotten though. He's a Yankee, he comes from the east, I think Pennsylvania. He was hired by the government to do a number of surveys at about this time throughout the state. He also did surveys in Iowa.
Good man that you could get for this if you could be bothered is A.L. Rouse, good Cornishman.
Well,
he's a Cornishman. You know, Bob got him here and had the lecture down here, and all we had to do was to fill the hall, and he would do it for free. And we more than filled the theater. And then he came out to the door afterwards to shake hands with any Cornishman because he emphasized so that they better be proud that they were Cornish. He's such a definite dyed-in-the-wool Cornishman. You know.
The Cornish are very history conscious.
Oh, yes.
Well,
I went up to Rouse's house, and his house wasn't so old. It only went back, I think, to 1300. But it was quite a country house in the state. The shrubbery and the landscaping outside, you knew, had been there for centuries, you know. But a most interesting person. He was very kind to me.
Elston Moyle of Madison. Have you ever met him?
No.
I'm surprised because he's probably in Wisconsin.
What's his name? Moyle.
Moyle, Dr. Moyle. He's a veterinarian. What you escaped from, Mr. Pembroke.
Yeah, that's right.
He's from a Racine County or Kenosha County bunch of Cornishmen, but very active in the Cornish family society. Well, enough about what I know. Our impression is that the Cornish came to run things, like the bank here came into Cornish hands sooner or later. But the Yankees, when they erected this town, set up a village square kind of situation up where the water tower is, very much along the New England traditional town plan arrangement. And the Cornish were given the opportunity to spread out with their irregular, by American lights, house plan arrangements and these strings of houses, because the mining lots within the community were surveyed in such a regular fashion to accommodate the law of 1836, which commanded that they not be larger than 4 acres. And so they were laid out according to geographical convenience.
What about Irving's edition?
Same darn thing. It looks Yankee, and he was Yankee.
Yeah. Well, that's all over in here.
Down this way. Right.
We're in Irving's. Well, of course, when we tried to tell the story to people, we said, well, of course, the first settlers were not Cornish. They did come. They were Yankees, or they came from the East Coast. And we never did determine, it was sort of conjecture with some facts about exactly when the Cornishmen did start or did come in any number. Well, one person in Dodgeville who did quite a lot of research on families, Gerald Fieldhouse, questioned us about our time when we suggested that it was 28, 29, and 30. He wasn't so sure. He said he thought we were a little bit too early. But then when he went back to Cornwall and found out the shipping list of the passage sheets, then he found out that there were Cornish that came, but the large groups that came were later.
I think the name of these Yorkshires.
In the 50s was the largest.
We haven't looked up the Goldsworthys,
have we? I believe, which is what we finally decided.
Yeah, we find 40s and 50s, most of the people in the row came in the 40s.
By the mid-40s, they were there.
Well, Mr. I think that's when the greatest economic difficulties were going on in Cornwall, which was the reason for the coming, of course.
Francis Klima was supposed to be the first one in here. 27,
yeah.
First Cornishman.
We're wondering, and so does Mr. Fieldhouse, whether there were not a few isolated Cornish down in Missouri, at Mineral Point, Missouri, and Potosi, Missouri, in the 20s, because already in the 20s, Cornishmen were mining in South Africa, in Panama. The Kinsmans, for example, spent a time in Panama and Colombia before coming here. So the Cornish in the 20s and the 30s, because not so much of economic difficulty in Cornwall, but because industrial revolution had created the steam engine. And through, for every man in the mines, 10 had a man pumps. When they invented the steam engine pump, they could free the men on the pumps. That meant there were too many people, and so they could go elsewhere to mine. And the Cornish were hired by the colonialists to go all over.
Well, the Joplin mines that sent up Dodge and a lot of the followers were the first settlers of Cornish or not.
I know that, but I'm curious to know whether there may have been Cornish in Missouri, let's say 3 or 4 years earlier than they came to Mineral Point.
Was Schoolcraft any help on that?
Not yet. He wasn't. We've looked at that, and Mr. Fieldhouse has done some looking at that, and we haven't reached any conclusion. What we have to do is to get into Missouri local records The courthouse is down there, and also any kind of early Missouri census material that we don't know about yet, as we have for the territorial census is here. And
William R. Smith's diary tells about, very definitely tells where the various smelters were, the small smelters. Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of that information, but I don't remember specifically that he tells about, emphasize anything about the Cornish, or when,
yeah,
when they came. He was here in what, 30, the diary's 36?
36, 37.
And there was quite a lot of activity in 36. More so than, that's what we call Captain Gerald.
After the region was made into a territory, organized as a territory, it became...
Well, you know, the
all we're doing is plugging in a lamp here. Okay, go on. You were saying?
I don't know what I was going to say.
Well, that very early, this is, we know that Martin was here in about 30.
Thomas Martin?
Right.
I was going to say, Caleb Atwater, in his book of Journey from Pershing to Washington, published in, I think, Cincinnati in 1833. Maybe was it before that? Well, anyway, a copy of it's in a point room. It says that when he went through here, there were piles of copper waiting to be smelted. And that's 27.
Mm-hmm.
So there's activity, a lot of activity here. If they were mining copper in that early day.
Well, you know, when Bill Kissenberg said that when they celebrated the centennial in 27, he said they were 3 years late. But it was
no, Kissenberg didn't say that. Samuel Hood said that.
Oh. It should have been 24.
Samuel Hood was a grandson of Matilda Hood. Grandson of Matilda Hood. And she was the first white woman settled
right
here.
Mm-hmm. Then we have plenty of records of. There's this one Cornishman who came out here in 32, just within a few days' time to serve in the Black Hawk regiments. They were trickling in slowly at a rather early date, but I think that it's post-36 when the rush comes. In politics, in Mineral Point, is there a distinction? Aha, Mr. Penworthy's eyes light up. Is there a distinction between Republicans and Democrats, whether you were a Yankee or a Cornishman, or can a Cornishman have been anything?
A Cornishman could have been anything.
What were they mostly, do you think, here in town? Who won?
I wouldn't know, Roy, whether you don't think. You think of it now as being Republican. That was Whigs, wasn't it?
Whigs until 53.
Whigs until
53.
1853,
they didn't stay that long.
There's a interesting journal on a trip from Pershing to Washington City by a missionary by the name of Denton, D-E-N-T-A-N, and he spent 5 days here in Mineral Point. The Dodgeville was nothing but consisted of five houses, mostly inhabited by drunkards. He says, I always show that up at Fieldhouse.
Oh, I think he likes that.
Did he get a kick out of...
Well, the Vintage Village up to Minnesota, that man certainly didn't have much regard for anything that he saw in Mineral Point.
Featherstone,
yeah.
Fanshawe, as they say.
Fanshawe.
Well, what is Mineral Point, you say, Republican today? When did it become Republican? When you were kids, no, Mr. Penworthy, Mr. Neal, what was it like?
I never was interested in politics enough to...
I'm that same way.
Really?
Honestly.
Well,
I don't think they cared one way or another, like Roy and I.
Oh, well, if you go back to the old newspaper records, you ought to be able to determine that.
Oh, yes, we could. We just wanted your impressions of it.
Well, strange enough, I don't remember any party politics coming into it. Mm-hmm. Sort of, I have a feeling that it was stronger Republican and gradually was changing to be more more of a Democratic area of the state. You think so?
Yeah. I wouldn't know.
Well, like with Lancaster and Platteville and Menlo Point, it seems like to me that in the last, since I've been here, that it's been a tendency to change, which is too late. But I sort of have the feeling that it was Republican before that, but I'm not sure.
I don't think it was identified as Republican or Democrat.
No, then I have to think back when I was a youngster in Stoughton. If anybody asked me that, I wouldn't be able to say was it predominantly Democratic or Republican.
Well, Wisconsin is very special because of the progressive difficulty too, since.
Oh yes, I can hear my granddad talking about the La Follettes.
Did he like them?
Oh, he had a great respect, and he went very often to hear him speak.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't agree with them, because when they were going to build the Capitol and they were going to spend all that money, he said he's out of his mind. Can you imagine? And I forget what it was, $2 or $3 million that they were going to spend, and I don't wonder what it did end up to cost. But he had a great respect for him as an individual, but not with his.
Spent too much money, huh? Were the progressives active down here, Mr. Neal?
I can't tell you. I wouldn't hazard a guess.
I wouldn't either.
Okay.
What was Mr. Gundry? Was he a Republican or a Democrat?
I never knew.
Of course, there was a time when you didn't want to declare yourself. I don't know why.
Well, no, Wisconsin is very proud of not having to declare its citizens, having had its citizens declare their party affiliation. Independence is the word here. Okay, enough about politics. That didn't get very far. Besides mining, what would you say are the economic bases for Mineral Point?
Farming.
Which was more important in your
farming
book?
I would say
farming in later years. Mining.
I'd rather work it for 50 cents a day than a dollar a day in there, out of the mine. Who was the old man that said that? You'd rather work for 50 cents a day in the mine than to be a dollar a day and be a farmer.
Well, that was Copeland's take.
Oh, yes.
Now, you make references to farms in practically on top of Pendarvis. There's a corner of farmland that seems to come down into that intersection. How does this happen? That's very unusual in Wisconsin. Usually farms don't impinge upon villages quite that, or cities, quite that directly.
Well, my first reaction to that would be that as mining was uncertain, or if they were going to strike a vein of lead. But farming was much more definite in the way of income. And then, of course, with the grazing lands, I'm not sure how far back cattle grazing goes. But, and then as the land petered out, if they did have a mine on a piece of land, then when that mine was done, then what else? Of course, then was the farming. Like the Rosses and the Harrises, any number of farms that are still close to Menlo Point.
Mm-hmm.
Almost some of them in the city limits. Mm-hmm.
There are some farms within the city limits.
That's right.
Not common in Wisconsin. Although Janesville has the same situation. It was platted as a very large place, and too large. Much of it was farmed, quite late. When you were boys here, did you work on farms ever? Were you asked to be hired hands, or did you always have to avoid butchering and yikes?
I worked on a farm a couple of summers.
You did?
Yeah.
Whose farm and where?
East of town, Irishman by the name of Walsh.
Dave Walsh?
Yeah, Dave's brother. There's a large family. There's Dave and Emma and Ruth, or Rose and Sarah. And Pete Welcher's who I worked for.
Grandfather had a farm, but I never worked on it. Yeah, I did.
You're lucky.
What did you do when you worked in the farm, Mr. Neal?
Led the horse in the hay fork.
Yeah, I did that. Huh? That was one of my things, drag the horse on the hay fork.
Yeah.
Help thresh.
Well, of course, his family weren't farmers. My family were farmers, and I started on the farm when I was 8. I dropped a tobacco when I was 8 years old, and I was so small that they didn't think I'd fall off the tobacco planter. And I worked on the farm from the time I was 8 until all the way through high school.
Well.
But it was just, my granddad had a little piece of land about 10 acres out on the edge of Stoughton where we raised tobacco, and that's where I was initiated.
But you were into farming. But you were a boy, you lived in Stoughton, but in the community itself.
But because my grandfather had this piece of land, that was the initiation to farming. And then